All of the cargo had been transferred to the foot of the rapids, and most of the dugouts had been successfully run through when their tightly choreographed portage suddenly unraveled. Cherry had wandered away from the rest of the men and was watching from the foot of the rapids as the three paddlers struggled with Roosevelt's balsa, the expedition's largest. They were trying to guide it through the same channel that they had used for the other dugouts. But the channel was too narrow for the large balsa, and it made a treacherously sharp turn right near the rocky shore. In trying to make the turn, Cherry would later write in his diary, the inside boat caught on the rocks and also against some bajucas, vines, and tree trunks. In the twinkling of an eye, the current had wrenched the outer boat loose, driven it under the prow of the inside boat that was thrown on its side. Both filled with water and sank. The two boats were pinned against a grouping of boulders, the racing current and each other, and the three camaradas alone could never have moved them. The power of the current was such that it might eventually dislodge the canoes, but if that happened, they would be catapulted downstream where they would be smashed to pieces on the jutting rocks. Cherry heard the camaradas yelling for help and rushed to their side to lend his strength. He quickly realized, however, that they would need every member of the expedition if they ever hoped to free the dugouts. Pulling himself out of the water, he ran to where the rest of the men were waiting and sounded the alarm. Terrified of losing two more canoes, the men all ran to help. Roosevelt was the first man in. His rushing into the water to assist was entirely characteristic of him, Cherry would later write. And he did this after many days of suffering from fever which had weakened his vitality. He could not stand idly watching others at a time when action was required. Yet even Cherry did not understand how great a risk Roosevelt was taking each time he dived into the roiling river. For the past 12 years, Roosevelt had had only one strong leg, his right. After a trolley car accident in 1902 had nearly crushed his left leg, he had been told that even the slightest injury to that leg could be dangerous, costing him part of the leg or, if left untreated, possibly even his life. 6 years later, while he was riding his horse around Oyster Bay, a branch had hit him on the shin. Even that slight rap had caused an inflammation that Roosevelt wrote, had grown so serious that Dr. Rixey had to hastily take it in hand. For a while, the White House doctor had thought that he might have to operate on Roosevelt's leg, but he had been able to check the inflammation before it advanced that far. On the River of Doubt, Dr. Cajazeira did not have anything close to the medical resources that Dr. Rixey had had access to in the White House. If Roosevelt re-injured his left leg, Cajazeira might be forced to attempt an operation in the rainforest that Rixey had been loath to perform in one of the best hospitals in the United States. If Roosevelt hurt his right leg, he would find himself all but paralyzed on an expedition that demanded long hikes over difficult terrain and through dense forest. Both of his legs would be uniquely vulnerable to injury and infection in the steaming jungle. Although the water level had fallen over the past few days, it was still deep enough to reach up to the men's armpits as they strove to reach the swamped canoes, slipping over moss-wrapped rocks and stumbling on the river's sharply uneven bed. When they reached the balsa, they used axes to cut away the ropes that had bound it. Kermit and 6 other men stripped down to the skin and swam to an island in the small series of falls just above the trapped canoes, from where they lowered a rope. Roosevelt and the rest of the men used all the strength they had left to wrench the canoes free and secure them to the rope, so that Kermit and his team could drag them up to the island. As the river roared darkly around him, making it almost impossible to keep his balance, Roosevelt suddenly slipped, striking his right shin against the sharp edge of a rock. Blood spun out of the wound like an unraveling spool of thread, mixing with the muddy water and disappearing downstream. Roosevelt immediately realized the gravity of this seemingly minor injury as he pulled himself out of the river and quietly limped back to camp, blood beginning to mat the hairs on his leg under his one remaining pair of pants. For Roosevelt, in a dripping rainforest where every muddy step throbbed with bacteria, parasites, and disease-carrying insects, this injury was potentially fatal. From that time on, Cherry wrote, he was a very sick man. When the men had finally rescued the sunken dugouts and were ready to start back down the river, they were buffeted by a rainstorm. For the next 3 or 4 hours, the rain fell in such heavy sheets that the men could not even see across the river. It was 4 p.m. before it slowed enough for them to resume their journey. Just 10 minutes later, however, they reached another sinister-looking series of rapids and were left with no choice but to make camp in the rain. Trying to help a limping, quickly weakening Roosevelt, while fumbling with their waterlogged dugouts, rain-drenched bags, and the officers' 2 slick tents, the men moved as fast as they could, but they could not protect themselves or their injured commander from the deluge. Practically everything we had was soaked, Cherry wrote, and our camp was a dreary one. On the morning of the 28th, the men left camp early, but they were on the river for less than a mile when they were stopped by the rapids that they had seen the day before. While Rondon, Lira, Kermit, and Antonio Correa hiked ahead to find out just what awaited them downstream, Cherry and Dr. Cajazeira watched over Roosevelt. But even their careful attention could not halt the consequences of his injury. Although only one night had passed since he had crushed his leg, an infection had already begun to bubble in the wound, and his temperature had spiked in a sudden attack of malaria. The result was a transformation as startling as it was ominous. After only a few hours away from camp, Kermit returned to find that his father's condition had worsened dramatically, changing the ex-president from an injured but able man to an invalid scarcely able to rise from his cot. As Roosevelt's condition swiftly deteriorated, so did the expeditions. After fighting their way along the river's edge for about a mile of what Kermit termed miserable going, the men who were scouting ahead of the expedition came to a gorge that was so tall and steep that the sheer cliffs that bordered the river seemed to lunge toward each other, squeezing the water through a narrow passage. Within this gorge, which was more than a mile long, the men found a series of 6 waterfalls, each larger and more treacherous than the last. The final fall was more than 30 feet high. It was immediately apparent that the expedition's awkward dugout canoes could never survive these falls, even empty. The only way around them would be for the camaradas to build a corduroy road and portage everything, from cargo to canoes. When the 4 men studied the surrounding land, however, they discovered that it would be almost impossible to carry even their baggage around the falls, much less haul the massive dugouts. The gorge, Rondon realized, had been carved from hornfels, a hard, fine-grained, and slippery stone. There was no way, he told the men who were standing dejectedly at his side, that they could carry the canoes over the steep, jagged, and rocky pass. When they returned to camp, Rondon assembled the weary and frightened men in front of him and explained the situation in blunt, unemotional terms. Cherry wrote that he would never forget the expression on Rondon's face as he delivered the crushing news. We shall have to abandon our canoes, and every man fight for himself through the forest. Cherry was as incredulous as the camaradas. To all of us, his report was practically a sentence of death, the naturalist wrote. Unless they stayed close to the river's steep and heavily forested edge, they would not be able to find their way out of the jungle. The thought of losing their way terrified even the most hardened and experienced men among them. In the mid-20th century, the Polish explorer and writer Arkady Fielder wrote of the dangers of becoming lost in the Amazon. Many cases have been known of travelers and explorers returning from its green labyrinth to become chronic patients of sanatoria, or even not returning at all, he wrote. They have simply disappeared in the forest like stones in water. The jungle is jealous and voracious. Of all the possible deaths man can die in the jungle, the most dreaded is that which results from being lost. Cherry and Kermit's greatest concern, however, was for Roosevelt. As devastating as it was for the other men, the idea of abandoning the canoes meant certain death for Roosevelt, and he knew it. Cherry wrote that, although Roosevelt did not utter a word of complaint when he heard Rondon's decision, the effect of Rondon's report on him, with his feeling of keen responsibility to us all, immediately caused Cherry to fear what the ex-president might do in response. One of Roosevelt's most entrenched beliefs as a cowboy, a hunter, a soldier, and an explorer was that the health of one man should never endanger the lives of the rest of the men in his expedition. Roosevelt had unflinchingly cast off even good friends like Father Zahm when it became clear that they could no longer pull their own weight or were simply not healthy enough to endure the physical demands of the journey.
"No man has any business to go on such a trip as ours, unless he will refuse to jeopardize the welfare of his associates by any delay caused by a weakness or ailment of his," he wrote. "It is his duty to go forward, if necessary, on all fours, until he drops."
Roosevelt had always applied this wilderness law more strictly to himself than to anyone else. When he was a rancher in the Dakota Territories, he had had several painful accidents, once smashing his rib on a stone when he was bucked off his horse, and another time cracking the point of his shoulder when a big, sulky horse named Ben Butler flipped over backward while Roosevelt was still riding him. Every time he had been hurt, Roosevelt had forced himself to go on. "We were hundreds of miles from a doctor, and each time, as I was on the roundup, I had to get through my work for the next few weeks as best I could, until the injury healed of itself," he had written. Roosevelt had even held himself to these unyielding standards after Schrank, the would-be assassin, shot him in Milwaukee. Few men would have even considered giving a speech with a bullet in their chest. Roosevelt had insisted on it. This was an approach to life and death that he had developed many years earlier when living with cowboys and soldiers.
"Both the men of my regiment and the friends I had made in the old days in the West were themselves a little puzzled at the interest shown in my making my speech after being shot," he wrote. "This was what they expected, what they accepted as the right thing for a man to do under the circumstances, a thing the non-performance of which would have been discreditable, rather than the performance being creditable."
Roosevelt had never allowed himself to fear death, famously writing, "Only those are fit to live who do not fear to die." From a very young age, he had been prepared to die in order to live the life he wanted. When a doctor at Harvard told him that his heart was weak and would not hold out for more than a few years unless he lived quietly, he had replied that he preferred an early death to a sedentary life. After the Spanish-American War, he had written his friend Henry Cabot Lodge that, although he was then only 39 years old, he was "quite content to go now. I am more than satisfied, even though I die of yellow fever tomorrow." Driven in part by his father's decision to pay another man to fight for him in the Civil War, Roosevelt had a passion for military combat that, to a large degree, had shaped his adult life. "I had always felt that if there were a serious war, I wished to be in a position to explain to my children why I did take part in it, and not why I did not take part in it," he had written in his autobiography just months before heading to South America. Many of Roosevelt's friends, however, suspected that he wanted not only to fight in a war, but to die in one. "The truth is, he believes in war, and wishes to be a Napoleon and to die on the battlefield," former President William Howard Taft had written of his estranged friend. "He has the spirit of the old berserkers." There was no question that Roosevelt considered the descent of the River of Doubt to be a great cause, a cause that was, like war, worth dying for. To John Barrett, the former Director General of the Pan-American Union, he wrote, "If I had to die anywhere, why not die in helping to open up to the knowledge of the world a great unknown land, and so aid humanity in general, and the people of Brazil in particular?" Roosevelt had also terrorized Henry Fairfield Osborne, the president of the American Museum of Natural History, under whose auspices he was traveling, with his assurances that, if necessary, he was quite ready to leave his bones in South America. So determined was Roosevelt not to endanger the life of anyone else in his expedition that he had made a secret provision for a quick death in the Amazon, should it become necessary. Before he even left New York, he had packed in his personal baggage, tucked in among his extra socks and 8 pairs of eyeglasses, a small vial that contained a lethal dose of morphine. I have always made it a practice on such trips to take a bottle of morphine with me, because one never knows what is going to happen, he told the journalist, Oscar Davis. I always meant that if at any time death became inevitable, I would have it over with at once, without going through a long, drawn-out agony from which death was the only relief. Now, on the River of Doubt, that vial of morphine represented his only chance to avoid becoming a burden to the other men in the expedition, especially his own son. He knew that he could not possibly make it through the dense jungle on his own, and that Kermit and the other men would try to carry him. Simply carrying the provisions that they would need to stay alive would take more strength than they had. Roosevelt refused to slow down the expedition when each man was fighting for his own life. For him, this was not about suicide. It was about doing the right thing. That night, after the rest of the men had retired to their hammocks, caught up in their own worries about what lay ahead of them, Cherry and Kermit agreed to take turns keeping watch over Roosevelt, whose condition had continued to worsen. Both men realized that it would be a long, difficult night, but neither of them was prepared for the decision that Roosevelt would make by morning. Just before dawn, Cherry was awakened by the sound of Roosevelt's weak voice calling for him.
"Cherry! Cherry!"
The naturalist sprang from his hammock and stood with Kermit before Roosevelt. Lying on his small, rusted cot, the injured ex-president talked about the dangers that they faced with or without their canoes. Then, without a trace of self-pity or fear, Roosevelt informed his friend and his son of the conclusions he had reached.
"Boys, I realize that some of us are not going to finish this journey. Cherry, I want you and Kermit to go on. You can get out. I will stop here."
Part 5. Despair. Chapter 23. Missing. Thousands of miles away, in New York City, Roosevelt's family and friends had begun to fear the worst. They had been prepared to lose contact with Roosevelt for several weeks, perhaps even months. They were not prepared, however, for the news that they had received on March 23rd, when the New York Times announced that Roosevelt had lost everything in the rapids of the River of Doubt and that his whereabouts were unknown. Accompanying the article was a large but strikingly incomplete map of Mato Grosso, Brazil, the region through which Roosevelt was known to be traveling, and a picture of the former president framed in a circle in the left-hand corner. A series of 14 headlines filled much of the far right-hand column, spilling down the page in a cascade of speculation and fragments of information. "Maybe on unknown river," one headline read. "District never explored. Party had been divided. No word yet to family." The article had been sparked by a telegram that Anthony Fiala, the expedition's outfitter, had sent to the newspaper the day before from Santarém, Brazil, a relatively large town on the Amazon River to which he had made his way after successfully descending the Papagaio River. The telegram was only 2 sentences long, but it was notable both for its brief but startling description of a disaster in the rapids and its omission of any news about Theodore Roosevelt. "We have lost everything in the rapids," Fiala had written. "Telephone my wife of my safety." At that time, no one outside of the expedition, including even Fiala's wife, knew that Fiala had been bumped from the descent of the River of Doubt and relegated to a different journey. They assumed that the quartermaster was still with the expedition he had outfitted and that, because he had lost everything, so had Roosevelt. The newspaper did its best to reassure its readers that Roosevelt was probably safe. The fact that Fiala had not mentioned Roosevelt, the article argued, was a good sign rather than a bad one. Mr. Fiala's silence on the subject indicates that the colonel is safe, the article read. The understanding with Mr. Fiala was that any personal injury to the colonel was to be cabled immediately and fully. This argument, however, must have been cold comfort to Edith Roosevelt and her children. The absence of any word on Roosevelt's condition was conspicuous and alarming. Why had Fiala not mentioned the former president's safety when he telegrammed his own? And if he had been in a position to send a telegram to New York, why hadn't Roosevelt? Since her return from South America in December, and Margaret's death just a few weeks later, Edith had tried to find distractions that would keep her too busy to worry about her husband and son. But she was struggling. Earlier in the year, she had moved into a hotel in New York City so that she could be near her daughter Ethel during the final months of Ethel's first pregnancy. After the baby was born on March 7th, Edith had stayed in the city for another week to help her daughter. She had then traveled to Groton, the prestigious boarding school in northern Massachusetts, which all of the Roosevelt boys had attended, to witness her youngest son, Quentin's, confirmation. 10 days later, on March 25th, she had finally returned to Sagamore Hill, her peaceful but conspicuously empty home on Oyster Bay. Edith had been at Groton when Fiala's telegram reached the New York Times. By then, she had not heard from her husband in nearly a month, and she had no idea where he was, or even if he was still alive. Representatives of the American Museum of Natural History, presumably at the urging of Henry Fairfield Osborne, had sent a cable to the American consul in Para, Brazil, the same night the article had appeared. "Can you obtain any information concerning the Roosevelt party?" the telegram read. "Advised by telegraph at earliest possibility. All expenses guaranteed." The next day, Fiala, still in Santarém, had sent another longer telegram to the New York Times. To everyone's great relief, he explained that, as part of the expedition plan, he had left Roosevelt's party at Utiariti to descend the Papagaio River. "The Roosevelt party is in good health, exploring the Duvida River," he assured the newspaper. It must have been clear to Edith, however, that Fiala had no more ability to know whether the Roosevelt party was in good health or bad than she did. The story of his own disaster on a much less dangerous river did not ease her mind. Nor did the April release of the first articles in the series that Roosevelt was writing for Scribner's. Filled with stories of man-eating fish and warlike Indians, these articles only served to feed Edith's fears and multiply in her mind the dangers that her husband and son were facing. While Edith had spent much of her life worrying about her husband, Theodore had roamed the world in search of adventure and achievement, never showing much concern about leaving his family. After his first wife's death, he had left his infant daughter in his sister Bammy's care and fled to the Dakota Territories. At the start of the Spanish-American War, he had been desperate to get to the front, even though Edith, who was struggling to recover from surgery that had probably saved her life, had asked him not to enlist. When he got his wish and was able to make his way to the heart of the war, Roosevelt had sent a letter home to his wife and children, bluntly stating that he probably had a 2 in 3 chance of survival, and asking Edith to give his sword and revolver to Theodore Jr. and Kermit, who were then only 10 and 8 years old, if he did not make it home alive. Edith had read the letter aloud to her 2 oldest boys, who buried their heads in her lap and sobbed. After leaving the White House, Roosevelt had increasingly begun to bring his children, at least his sons, with him when he traveled. Kermit had been a restless 18-year-old college student when his father had invited him on his African safari, and he had savored every moment. The Amazon expedition, however, had come when Kermit, 24 years old, just beginning to make his own way in the world and in love, wanted to be almost anywhere in the world but on a remote river in the rainforest. Kermit had succeeded in convincing his father that, as Roosevelt had written to Ethel, his feelings would really have been hurt if I had not let him come on this trip. But Roosevelt understood how difficult it was for his son to be apart from his fiancée so soon after their engagement and while plans for their wedding were taking shape without him. The fact that Kermit had put his wedding and his life on hold for this expedition had weighed heavily on Roosevelt from the beginning of their journey. "I wish he would have gone straight to Belle," he had written Ethel. Although she missed Kermit, Belle, for her part, had not been suffering during the months of the expedition as her fiancé and her mother-in-law had. As Kermit fought for his own and his father's survival on the River of Doubt, Belle happily settled into her new role as the fiancé of a Roosevelt while continuing to live the life of a transatlantic aristocrat. From her hotel in Madrid, she traveled to New York, made trips into neighboring France, and while there, occasionally crossed the English Channel. In London, she had even been presented to the court of St. James. In January, with a brief cable to their friends back in Richmond, Virginia, Belle's parents had announced their daughter's engagement to Theodore Roosevelt's son, and the newspapers had quickly picked up the story. A few days after Fiala's disturbing telegram had appeared in the New York Times, Belle and her mother had been spotted in Paris happily shopping for her trousseau. When a correspondent for the Washington Post inquired, Belle smilingly admitted the nature of her errand. Less than 2 weeks later, she was back in New York, attending the opera with her anxious future mother-in-law. While Belle charmed Europe, Kermit missed her deeply, almost obsessively. Although she had shown a flirtatious interest in him throughout their long-distance courtship, Belle had never seemed to yearn for Kermit with the intensity that he had for her. When he complained that he had not heard from her in far too long, she had insisted that she had written to him, although always in a rush. "I have sent you quite a lot of letters in the last few months, all very hasty and untidy and incoherent," she had written teasingly. "I can't imagine why you haven't received them. However, if not writing will bring you to Spain, I think I shall cease entirely." During the expedition, Kermit's longing for Belle had only deepened. On the overland journey, he used to break away from the rest of the expedition to go hunting with his big white mule and his beloved dog, Trigueiro. He particularly loved the vast, empty deserts of the Brazilian highlands, where he could wander alone, dreaming of Belle. "The desert has always been a very good friend of mine," he had once tried to explain to her. Belle could have had no doubt as to the intensity of Kermit's feelings for her, for he had written to her until he had finally run out of stationery as he made his way across the highlands to the River of Doubt, and he had never failed to tell her how much he ached for her. "You must be getting very tired of hearing me say how lonely I am for you," he had written in late January. "But it's what I am all the whole time, and I can't keep it out of my letters. Oh, Belle, dearest, dearest one, it just seems too good to believe that we'll ever be together." Reading Kermit's letters, it is difficult to remember that he barely knew Belle. Not only were the two young expatriates separated by thousands of miles, but they were fundamentally different people. Kermit's and Belle's childhoods, and the expectations placed upon them by their parents, could not have been more different. They both came from wealthy, well-known families, but Belle had been raised in the rarefied world of high society, whereas Kermit, although the son of a president, had spent most of his childhood tearing through the woods of Oyster Bay. Even Roosevelt's sister, Bammy, had commented that she never knew of such a badly brought-up family. Instead of stressing things like table manners, he himself was a notoriously sloppy eater, Roosevelt had expected his sons to know how to shoot a gun, skin a rabbit, and chop down a tree. Even when his family lived in the White House, he had winked at his children's mischievous, even mildly destructive adventures. Kermit, who had been 12 years old when his father became president, had regularly brought his kangaroo rat with him in his pocket to breakfast, and his younger brother Archie had used the passenger elevator to transport his pony to the second floor. The house became one general playground for Roosevelt's children and their associates, Erwin Hoover, a longtime White House employee, once wrote. Nothing was too sacred to be used for their amusement, and no place too good for a playroom. The children seemed to be encouraged in these ideas by their elders, and it was a brave man indeed who would dare say no or suggest putting a stop to those escapades. The Roosevelt men were rough around the edges, but they were also vulnerable to what Roosevelt's older daughter Alice characterized as a melancholic streak that she believed ran in the family. Of all Roosevelt's sons, Kermit was perhaps at greatest risk of falling prey to this family melancholy. Although he was smart and strong, he did not have his father's ability to forge his own happiness. Even Edith, Kermit's greatest admirer, acknowledged that there was a dark side to her blonde son. In a letter that she had written to Roosevelt's sister Bammy just months earlier, she had referred to Kermit as the one with the white head and the black heart. Her second son, she had once explained, had always been odd and independent, and had seemed to prefer his own company to any other, with the occasional exception of his mother's. He never need retire to a cloister for a life of abstraction from outside interests, Edith had once written to her sister Emily. I believe I am the only person he really cares for. While at Groton, Kermit had also begun to drink, heavily enough at times for even the rector, Endicott Peabody, to notice. When Peabody confronted Kermit, the young man had become so angry that he had thought that he and the rector were going to come to blows. Kermit's brooding temperament and early taste for alcohol were character traits that Roosevelt had seen in his only brother Elliot, who had died at the age of 34 from complications related to alcoholism and morphine addiction. In childhood, Elliot had been as charming and light-hearted as his older brother had been awkward and serious. He had been the stronger, taller, more athletic of the two Roosevelt boys. But as he had approached adolescence, Elliot had begun to lose his footing, developing, as one biographer put it, an inclination toward poetic introspection, and a desire for solitude that was hauntingly similar to that of his future nephew. When their father died in 1878, Theodore, who had been at Harvard and had not witnessed the horrible ravages brought on by the final stages of cancer, was devastated. Elliot, who had been at their father's side throughout his illness, nearly lost his mind. Elliot gave unstintedly a devotion which was so tender that it was more like that of a woman, their sister Corrine recalled, and his young strength was poured out to help his father's condition. Theodore Sr.'s final days stayed with Elliot for the rest of his short life. He was so mad with pain, he would later remember with horror, that beyond groans and horrible writhes and twists, he could do nothing. Oh, my God, my father, what agonies you suffered! 4 years later, Elliot fell in love with a young society beauty named Anna Hall, who, like Belle Willard, came from a wealthy, well-connected family. Just as Belle now seemed to Kermit almost untouchable in her perfection, so did Elliot romanticize and idealize Anna. She seems to me so pure and so high and ideal that in my roughness and unworthiness I do not see how I can make her happy, he wrote. In December 1883, Elliot and Anna married. 2 months later, Theodore lost his young wife Alice to Bright's disease. Theodore survived the tragedy, but Elliot, who seemingly had everything he could hope for, slowly unraveled. He and Anna had 3 children, among them Eleanor, who grew up to marry her distant cousin Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But their marriage was a travesty. As the years passed, Elliot sank progressively deeper into alcoholism, morphine addiction, and a series of scandalous affairs that humiliated his proud wife and alienated his puritanical brother. In the end, Theodore simply gave up on Elliot. He finally had his brother admitted to an asylum in Paris and declared incompetent and insane. The next year, Anna died of diphtheria at the age of 29. refusing to see her husband, even on her deathbed. Had Elliot been a stronger man, the sorrow and shame surrounding his wife's early death might have turned his life around. But he was not, and it did not. 2 years later, Theodore wrote to Bammy that he wished their sister Corinne could get a little of my hard heart about Elliot. He can't be helped, and he must simply be let go his own gait. He is now laid up from a serious fall. While drunk, he drove into a lamp post and went out on his head. Poor fellow. If only he could have died instead of Anna. Elliot did die less than a month later, leaving 9-year-old Eleanor and her 2 siblings orphans. For Roosevelt, Elliot's death transported him back in time to 20 years earlier, when his brother was still a handsome, charming boy with a bright smile and a promising future. "I only need have pleasant thoughts of Elliot now," he wrote his sister Corinne. "He is just the gallant, generous, manly, loyal young man whom everyone loved." When Roosevelt saw his brother's body, he was more overcome than I have ever seen him, Corinne later recalled. He cried like a little boy for a long time. Throughout Kermit's adolescence and young adult life, Roosevelt had gone to great lengths to keep his son focused and industriously occupied. When Kermit was at Groton, his father, who was then president, always found time to monitor his schoolwork closely. In an attempt to encourage his son in any interest that he himself viewed as positive and worthwhile, Roosevelt had even rescued Edwin Arlington Robinson, the down-and-out American poet to whom Kermit had become devoted while at Groton. After leaving Harvard, Robinson had fallen into obscurity, misery, and alcoholism. Kermit had sent one of Robinson's works to the White House and asked his father if he could help the poet. Although Roosevelt admitted that he did not think he truly understood Robinson's poetry, he not only gave him a position as a special agent in the New York Treasury, but he reviewed The Children of the Night for Outlook magazine, thus bringing his writing to a much wider audience than it had ever had. "I do not like to think of where I should be now, if it had not been for your astonishing father," Robinson later wrote to Kermit. "He fished me out of hell by the hair of the head." Determined to keep his son from descending into the blackness that had swallowed Elliot and had nearly destroyed Robinson, Roosevelt had taken Kermit along on his most challenging adventures and had always given him a mission, something to work toward, something to give him a sense of direction and accomplishment. Besides encouraging Kermit in his schoolwork and literary interests, Roosevelt had exposed him to the physical challenges that had toughened his own body and mind. While Kermit was at Groton, Roosevelt had sent him to South Dakota one summer to work in the Badlands that had been his own salvation after Alice's death. Africa, too, had been a constant physical challenge, and Roosevelt had watched with soaring pride as his son thrived on the difficult work. "We worked hard. Kermit, of course, worked hardest, for he is really a first-class walker and runner," Roosevelt had written proudly from the Sudan to Kermit's brother Archie. "Kermit has really become not only an excellent hunter, but also a responsible and trustworthy man, fit to lead." Standing next to Roosevelt's prone, sweat-soaked figure in their dim tent beside the River of Doubt, Kermit met his father's decision to take his own life with the same quiet strength and determination that the elder Roosevelt had so carefully cultivated and admired in him. This time, however, the result would be different. For the first time in his life, Kermit simply refused to honor his father's wishes. Whatever it took, whatever the cost, he would not leave without Roosevelt. In the fraction of a second that passed between Roosevelt's grim declaration and Kermit's reaction, father and son reversed the roles that had defined their relationship, and which neither of them had ever questioned. Over nearly a quarter century, through lectures, letters, camping trips, grand adventures, and strong example, Roosevelt had molded Kermit in his own image, creating a young man who, given a goal, would fight with everything he had to achieve it. But although Roosevelt was proud of his son's growing independence, he had always remained the patriarch, continuing to make the final decisions. On this night, Kermit not only refused to do what his father asked of him, but demanded that Roosevelt step back and let his son determine his and the entire expedition's course of action. Recognizing the resolve on his son's face, Roosevelt realized that if he wanted to save Kermit's life, he would have to allow his son to save him. "It came to me, and I saw that if I did end it, that would only make it more sure that Kermit would not get out," Roosevelt would later confide to a friend. "For I knew he would not abandon me, but would insist on bringing my body out, too. That, of course, would have been impossible. I knew his determination. So there was only one thing for me to do, and that was to come out myself." Chapter 24. The Worst in a Man. Theodore Roosevelt had decided to live. In the past, that would have been enough. On the River of Doubt, however, his decision would save him only from himself. He was still perilously ill, and he and his men still faced a deep, rocky gorge, an impassable series of rapids, and a commander who believed that their only hope lay in abandoning their canoes and striking out into the pathless jungle. With the growing infection in his leg and his raging fever, Roosevelt knew that he would never be able to survive a forced march through the rainforest, no matter how determined he was to do so. Although his will was strong, his body was not. For the first time in his adult life, Roosevelt would have to rely on someone else's physical strength to pull him through. He would have to rely on his son. Kermit had been battling malaria almost since the expedition began, but he was still strong, and he had the endless endurance of youth. Having inherited his father's unshakable confidence, Kermit was certain that he could get the expedition's dugouts through the canyon. The problem was convincing the other men. "Kermit," Roosevelt would later write, "was the only man who believed we could get the canoes down at all." The young man's conviction, however, quickly swayed not just Cherry, but also, even more important, Lira. The Brazilian navigator had been Rondon's right-hand man for much of his life, but he had spent the past month working side by side with Kermit as they struggled to get past one series of rapids after another. Lira had come to respect Kermit's energy, courage, and, more to the point, considerable dexterity with ropes, a skill that he had gained while helping to build bridges in other corners of Brazil. Rondon still believed that the effort was a lost cause, but when confronted by these three determined men, he agreed to do what he could to help. Kermit's plan was to lower the empty dugouts down the falls with ropes, while the camaradas carried the baggage over the steep canyon cliffs. In order to make the plan even feasible, the men first had to whittle down their cargo yet again. This purge, their fourth since their expedition had begun, was particularly difficult because there was little left they could afford to lose. Nonetheless, the men examined their baggage with miser's eyes, cutting down everything except the food, Kermit wrote in his diary. Roosevelt kept only two small bags. One was his cartridge bag, which, along with his cartridges, held the head net and gauntlets that he used to protect himself while he wrote. The other bag, a duffel, contained his cot, a blanket, and a mosquito net, as well as a meager set of personal items. A single pair of pajamas, one extra pair of underwear, a pair of socks, six handkerchiefs, his wash kit, his pocket medicine case, some gun grease, adhesive plaster, a bottle of fly dope, needles and thread, his spare eyeglasses, his wallet, and a letter of credit, which would be essential should the expedition reach Manaus. He gave the shoes that he had been wearing to Kermit, whose own shoes had finally disintegrated, and pulled on his only spare pair. With the expedition's supplies cut down to the barest necessities, Lyra and Kermit climbed to the top of the gorge and prepared to lower the dugout canoes. Although they had used this method to hoist their boats over falls in the past, they had never before been forced to work in such extreme circumstances. The canyon walls were so steep, an almost vertical line from ridge to river, that at times the men had to cling to narrow, crumbling rock shelves while they struggled with the rough ropes and their massive cargo. The work was not only difficult and laborious in the extreme, but hazardous, Roosevelt later recalled. The chances that the dugouts would not survive the ordeal, moreover, were very high. The men understood that even if the plan worked, they might still end up spending several days at the other end of the gorge building new canoes. The canyon walls were also far too steep for a cargo carry. Instead of walking along the river as they had in the past, the camaradas would have to hike some distance away and then carve a trail more than 350 feet up the side and over the top of the densely forested mountain. While Kermit and Lyra struggled with the canoes, Rondon and a team of camaradas began to scout out a path. At the summit, Rondon stopped and ordered his men to cut down a few trees so that he could have an unimpeded view of the horizon. What he and later Cherry saw from that mountaintop only made their situation seem even more hopeless than they already believed it to be. In the valley below, we could see the Rio Roosevelt rushing like an arrow of light straight away toward the distant hills, there to disappear into the somber forest, Cherry wrote. It was a beautiful view, but it filled everyone with dread. We had learned that wherever the river entered among the hills, it meant rapids and cataracts, and our strength and courage alike were almost exhausted. We again discussed the possibility of having to abandon our canoes, but dreaded to think what our fate would be should we be forced to do so. It took 4 days, but the expedition's men, baggage, and canoes finally emerged from the northern end of the canyon on April 1st. Although this extraordinary achievement had likely saved their lives, there were no celebrations in the camp that night. The men were too exhausted and sick, and they had not escaped from the canyon unscathed. On the third day of the portage, Kermit and Lyra, in spite of all that they had done to protect their precious cargo, had watched helplessly as one of their dugouts had slipped from its rope and was smashed among the rocks on the river's bottom. To add to the men's unhappiness on their first night beyond the gorge, the heavens opened, and they were swept up in a rainstorm that was so punishing that even Rondon referred to it as tempestuous. It rained so hard that the canvas awnings that the men had rigged up collapsed under the weight of the water, and they feared that their remaining 5 canoes would be swamped. The storm even drove rain under the officer's tent, drenching Roosevelt as he lay on his cot, his fever raging. The men began the next day, April 2nd, more exhausted than they had ever been, following 4 days of a perilous portage and a terrible night's sleep. Although they looked forward to their return to the river, it brought with it little opportunity for rest. With only 5 canoes, everyone but Roosevelt and the paddlers had to walk. After less than 2 miles, moreover, the expedition reached yet another steep-sided canyon. Instead of getting out of the hills at once as we hoped to do, Cherry despaired, we are deeper in among them. By that point, the men had been fighting rapids for a month straight since they had heard the river's first roar on March 2nd. During that month, they had made only 68 miles and descended nearly 500 feet. Worse than this portage or even the last was the probability that countless more awaited them downstream. No one can tell how many times the task will have to be repeated, or when it will end, or whether the food will hold out, Roosevelt wrote. Every hour of work in the rapids is fraught with the possibility of the gravest disaster, and yet it is imperatively necessary to attempt it. Failure to get through means death by disease or starvation. The brutal job of getting through and around the rapids had begun to destroy what remained not only of the Kamaradish health, but also of their hope. Each new series of rapids reminded them of their drowned companion, Simplicio, and each portage held the threat of a snake or Indian attack and the promise of heartbreaking toil. So dejected were the Kamaradish that they began asking the officers if they really believed that they would ever get out of the jungle alive. The officers were as frightened and unsure as their men, but felt obliged to put on a brave face. "We had to cheer them up as best we could," Roosevelt wrote. From the beginning of the expedition, Roosevelt had worried about the Kamaradish and done what he could to bolster their spirits. In the weeks of trying hardships, when the fates seemed all against us, despite the fever and dysentery that were sapping his strength, he never failed, day after day, to make inquiry about his camp companions, including the canoemen and camp helpers, Cherry wrote of Roosevelt. Early on, Roosevelt had begun giving the Kamaradish chocolate bars at noon from his meager supply. The men treasured this treat so much that instead of immediately devouring it, they would hoard it until 3 p.m., when they would make it into a mid-afternoon meal. It was a strange form of food for the Brazilian interior, and was especially enjoyed by the laborers, Rondon wrote. Those little daily acts of thoughtfulness were much appreciated, and the men soon loved him. Now that their food supplies were so low and their chances for survival worsening, the ailing Roosevelt did more than give the Kamaradish chocolate. He began to give them his own share of rations. When Kermit and Cherry realized what he was doing and protested, Roosevelt simply replied, "I can't do anything to help, and they need the food." "We had to watch him constantly," Cherry wrote. "It reached the point where if he didn't eat all of his share, either Kermit or I would take what was left and guard it until a later meal. We had so very little that every mouthful counted." By this point in the expedition, many of the Kamaradish had become visibly depressed, and the officers worried about their sullen attitudes and deteriorating morale. "A sense of gloom pervaded the camp," Cherry wrote. On March 30th, Kermit had written in his diary that the men were very disheartened. Rondon insisted that they were still in good spirits, but even he had to admit that the rapids were causing considerable suffering to our men, and that with very few exceptions they had broken down. The officers knew that frightened and unhappy men were not only hard to motivate, but potentially dangerous. Outnumbering the officers by more than 2-1 and with no possibility of outside interference, the Kamaradish could easily wrest control of the expedition from their commanders. Rondon had fought against mutiny and its precursors, fear and frustration, his entire career. He knew its signs, and he knew that this expedition had all the right ingredients for it. Cherry, too, had had enough experience with disgruntled Kamaradish to be wary of them. During an earlier expedition, a man he had dismissed from his team of guides had tried to kill him. In an exchange of gunfire, Cherry had ended up killing the man instead, but not before being seriously wounded. He had nearly bled to death trying to get to help, and he would never again have complete use of one of his arms. The officers on the River of Doubt were fortunate. With very few exceptions, their Kamaradish were good, decent, and trustworthy men. As the weeks had passed, however, and their situation had steadily worsened, they had grown increasingly desperate. "Under such conditions," Roosevelt wrote, "whatever is evil in men's natures comes to the front." The men awoke on the morning of April 3rd with little hope for an easy or successful day. Their plan for getting the dugouts through the second gorge consisted of three distinct and progressively more grueling stages. The first stage involved running the empty boats down the river as far as they could safely take them. When the river became too rough, they would lower the canoes over the rapids by ropes. Then, at the point at which the ground began to level, they would slash a trail through the forest, chop down trees for a corduroy road, and haul the dugouts along the bank to the mouth of the gorge. Disaster struck almost immediately, during the first and easiest stage of the plan. While Antonio Correa and another camarada were steering one of the canoes down the river, they suddenly lost control and found themselves being swept toward the rapids. They desperately grasped at the branches and vines that looped over the bank, but the current was too strong, and the branches simply snapped in their hands. Realizing that they were about to be hurled into the rapids, the two men finally dived into the rushing river and watched as the dugout was, in Cherry's words, whirled out of their hands to be crushed to splinters in the whirlpools and rapids below. Their expedition was left once again with only four dugouts, two of which they had built themselves. Adding to the men's already overwhelming feeling of isolation and vulnerability, the work of pushing past the rapids obliged them to be scattered from one end of the canyon to the other. While Lira and his men were at the river's edge, cutting away undergrowth so that the canoes could be let down the falls, Rondon had assembled a team to carve a trail along the face of the cliff to the foot of the rapids. The rest of the camaradas, under Paishan's direction, were carrying the baggage to an intermediate station above the falls, where Kermit and Cherry were waiting to assemble the supplies. Only one man, a trusted and valued camarada, named Pedrinho, remained behind at the previous night's camp in order to guard the cargo, as it was slowly carted off. Early that morning, as the camaradas filed by in their dirty, tattered clothes, picking up boxes and hefting them onto tired shoulders, Pedrinho noticed some suspicious activity. Stepping forward, he surprised Julio de Lima, as the muscular camarada was once again slipping some food out of one of the ration tins. This time, he was taking dried meat, a particularly rare and treasured commodity, and Pedrinho immediately reported the theft to Paixón. Paixón was enraged to hear that the camarada had been caught stealing food once again. As serious as the theft was, however, there were few available options for punishment beyond a harsh rebuke. They had too much work to do to sacrifice one of the expedition's healthiest men to any sort of imprisonment. Soon after the theft, both Paixón and Julio returned to their places in the line of baggage carriers, and Pedrinho resumed his duties as camp guard. It was not long before Julio raised Paixón's ire again. As the other men hauled their heavy loads up the steep hillside, Paixón reprimanded Julio for not pulling his weight. At the intermediate station, Kermit and Cherry were waiting with the ailing Roosevelt, and all three men were attempting to distract themselves by reading when Julio appeared, groaning under the weight of his load and muttering to himself as he shuffled forward. When he heard Julio approach, Cherry looked up and joked to Roosevelt and Kermit, "One would know who that was by the groans." The two Roosevelts both gave a short laugh of acknowledgement and returned to their books. After Julio had set down his cargo, Cherry happened to look up and see the camarada walk over to a group of rifles which were leaning against a tree and pick up a carbine. The camaradas often carried rifles with them in case they saw game, so Cherry did not give much thought to Julio's action, other than to remark to Kermit and Roosevelt that Julio must have seen a monkey or bird near the trail. Only a few minutes after Julio had disappeared, the three Americans heard the unmistakable crack of the carbine going off. "I wonder what he has shot at," Roosevelt said, rousing himself from his illness. He, Kermit, and Cherry began to speculate, hoping that if Julio's shot had found its mark, whatever he hit would be fit for dinner. No sooner had they started savoring the prospect of a good meal, however, than they saw three camaradas running toward them up the trail. The men's voices reached them in a breathless panic.
"Julio mató Paixón!"
they shouted in Portuguese. "Julio has killed Paixón." Chapter 25. He Who Kills Must Die. As news of the murder spread across the Stone Canyon, the members of the expedition froze in fearful expectation, their ears primed to hear another rifle shot ring through the trees. No one believed that Paixón was Julio's only target. They were certain that the volatile camarada had snapped under the pressures and hardships of the expedition and gone on a killing spree. We all felt that Julio had run amok, and had probably determined